G'day and welcome to Radio Notes, where those in music talk life, those in life chat music, and more. I'm John Murch, and today's conversation is a little bit childish. As well, it goes over an hour. Just a bit of a heads up, if you're used to our usual less than hour episodes. It's a good one though, and here it is now.
During the 2020 Adelaide Fringe, Brymore Production had a focus of their performances to entertain and engage young minds through the Bureau of Untold Stories, a production that seeks to capture missing stories and construct narratives live. Today, an extended conversation with the creators behind this and other shows that aim to spark both joy, development, and very often educate, from the stage, their younger audiences. Holly and Sean joined us for a chat over a barrel at the Holden Street Theatres in Hindmarsh.
Holly and Sean, welcome to Radio Notes.
Thank you.
Hello.
Two-thirds of the Good for a Change podcast.
That is us,
yeah. Are we ever?
Can we talk about that first? Only discovered you because the Great Australian Podcast had mentioned you. Final episode of the season was back in February of 2020.
Yes.
Yes.
Talking about what I need to clear up with you. Are potato fritters, not cakes.
Oh, no.
Whoa.
No. Oh, gosh. We've crossed state borders, and this is where the issues start popping up. There's something different again, I think, in Brisbane. And yes, it was a contentious topic. I probably shouldn't have brought it up ever. Jared Fairclough, who is the third member of the team, is my best friend from high school. And we used to collaborate all the time on little YouTube shows on the weekend. We'd get together every weekend and we'd make a little YouTube show together. And as I moved away and moved overseas, I started to miss that creativity that we had on a regular basis. And when we came back to Melbourne, I was trying to find a way to reconnect with him and continue collaborating and bring Holly in on it as well. What eventuated was us deciding to make a podcast, and we sat there and decided what we were going to talk about. And
In a morning,
yeah.
We sat there and we were like, should we make a podcast today? Yeah, what should we do?
Let's just do something like that. And we thought we'll just do one episode and we'll see what it's like. And we recorded it and we thought, oh, gee, that sounds pretty good. I'd probably listen to that. From there on, we just kept doing it on a weekly basis and kept churning it out. And unfortunately, we had to take a pause because Holly and I were in Perth, Fringe World, and then over to the UK and Switzerland, and then now in Adelaide. And so we've had to pause for that reason.
That's Good for a Change. That's the podcast you all three are part of. You join us, though, to talk about the Brymore Productions that both of you two, sans him,
yes,
are actually part of. Where was the initial creative idea for this particular production company?
So we are married. When we met, Sean was a producer and I was studying theatre production. And so in that time, it wasn't kind of something that was an option for us. We weren't like, oh yeah, let's go do children's theatre. And then we did some theatre out here, and I was stage managing and Sean was producing a show, and we did that and we finished that. And I think
I'm hearing it was an excuse to spend more time together.
Oh yeah,
we are inseparable. I don't think other people would bear each other as much as we do. We sometimes literally do everything together. And when we were applying for Holly's permanent residency visa out here,
it looked like we were lying.
Yeah, it was like, we spend 24 hours a day together.
These are our contracts for the jobs that we do together. This is our theatre company that we made together. This is our house. This is like, all of our friends are just each other.
So that was a strange process. We'd been making theatre sort of separately, I guess, and Holly obviously was then working on this production that I was doing. And by the end of it, Holly said, well, I'm going back to the UK to study drama, or to study stage management, or at the time. And I didn't really know what I was going to do because I was sort of a little bit over producing at the time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure if it was where I wanted to go to. I think that sort of small to medium art sector out here for a producer, a theatre producer, is a difficult game to play.
Mm. When you were saying you were over producing, was it the workload or was it just that you had too many fingers in too many companies?
Honestly, I think the issue was financial, completely financial. I was the one that would start a job 3-4 months in advance before the show would start, if not longer. And then by the time it finished, I was still working a day job. I was paying actors, because our philosophy has always been to pay actors
what they're worth,
to get to the end of the process and then be like, oh, I've got $2 left in the profits, which is now mine, is a really difficult thing to kind of constantly face.
That's a frustration of yours, Holly, isn't it? That invoices just don't get paid.
Is it ever? Oh my gosh. We are currently waiting on an unnamed invoice. We've sent several emails about. Several calls. International calls that we've had to make to that one.
Which you'll invoice them.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
It'll keep racking up.
And it's just not. He was like, oh, it's going to be there. And we're like, okay. And we're like waiting. We're like, it's not there yet. Still no.
Where does that breakdown of communication happen? Is it that somewhere in the arts community someone thinks they're more important than someone else, or?
I think it's such a strange thing to be on the artist end.
You were saying you were paying your people, you only had a few dollars to your name, yeah. And here's other people not coming
us.
The other way around.
No. The toughest thing as an artist is to sit and watch people that you know are getting full-time wages not pay you. Because we do not get a full-time wage, a standard, everyday full-time wage from the work we kind of do. We are reliant on people paying their bills on time and being truthful to the contracts and things that they set out. And it's such a strange thing that it seems to happen so frequently to us, but also to other artists that we know as well.
And sometimes, like, it's an unfortunate turn of events, and, like, on the part of the person who is paying the invoice, it's something that can't be helped. And, like, I completely understand if something goes awry and you have a couple of days that you need to kind of hold off on, that's fine. But when there's a complete kind of cut off of communication and there's no sense of respect, I guess, for the fact that we depend on this as our wage, like, if this is our full-time work, we need for people to treat us as employees.
It has a massive impact on where we go next from this, because, you know, at the moment we're here in Adelaide. We sort of needed it for accommodation here. We need it to register our Edinburgh Fringe season this year, which is about to come up. So we're in this really awkward position now where we're sort of like floating, waiting to find out what happens next and what we're going to be able to pull off or not.
The issue that we've just raised there, or any others, how do you resolve those from an artist production point of view, but also being a couple, being married?
This is probably revealing the secret, but we sort of operate under a good cop, bad cop system, and it's probably a slightly more surprising way than you'd expect. If an issue arises, I'm generally the
good cop.
Communications base good cop. If things have gone wrong...
Sorry, Holly.
If things
what
have
can
gone
I say?
Wrong, we launch Holly into the fray. And then it's, you know, then there's a stern email from Holly, which I think is funny, because if you meet us in real life...
It's not what we're like.
It's not what we're like. not that I'm the bad cop necessarily, but I think we're both
and not cops. That we're not meeting in real life now. At that professional level, that Holly might be a, hello, 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 what do you think you're doing to me?
Yeah. It is a bit like that. Sean will be like, it's okay. And I'll be like, well, it's not okay, is it? It's not good.
I'm probably the more patient one.
Yeah. But we, in terms of like balancing it, it's difficult because it is our whole life. We do have to kind of sit down and find time to be like, okay, this is an issue we've got. We need to like find six ways to try and resolve it. And then we need to like call it quits because we have like life to do and we need to do the dishes and we need to clean our clothes.
And how does travel help or hinder that process?
I think the toughest thing for us at the moment is we haven't had our own house for over 6 months now. And we went from having fine little two-bedroom mid-terrace house in the UK on like the south coast to living with our parents, basically, which they have been wonderful, wonderful, supportive
extremely
grateful for that. But we were in a climate in the UK where we weren't earning enough in our day job to be able to make the international bookings that we were starting to pick up with the company. And we knew for the progression of the company, we had to make a call. But that has been really tough as a young, relatively recently married couple to go from having a house and having all of that to moving back in with your parents.
Doing things that aren't about the production company itself. For example, being tourists whilst you're doing your work.
Yeah. Oh, we love travel. I think that's one of the things that brings us together as a couple, is that we love an adventure and we love discovering stuff randomly.
And it's funny because we got married in, what, 2017? End of 2017. And then we didn't go on our honeymoon until March last year, 2019. We didn't have, like, an official honeymoon, but we went on so many holidays in between, but every single one was a work trip. So we didn't feel like we were missing out on that because we saw the whole of England in a year. And we really do like push to like see things and to experience things. And like we went to Switzerland the other month, went out and we saw Switzerland.
Yeah. We saw a lot of Geneva. Yeah. We did a lot of walking.
We did a lot of walking.
Well, even in recent days, many people here in South Australia and Adelaide have never seen the old gum tree.
Mm.
But you have.
That was pleasure, completely. Yeah. We wake up in the morning, we answer some emails, we do some marketing, we do whatever it takes to sort of plug the show, and then we go, okay, it's time to get out now. We don't have a show today. Let's go have some time to ourselves. Let's go see something. One of the websites we use quite often is Atlas Obscura. It's a wonderful compendium of strange and interesting places around the world. I'm not someone that picks up a lonely planet and goes, oh, I've got to go up the Empire State Building. I've got to do this. I've got to ride the London Eye. I've never been on the London Eye. I don't like the idea of it at all. But that's the joy of like Atlas Obscura, is that all these places suddenly pop up, and we've seen so many really cool and interesting things because of that website and trying to go off the beaten track and find stuff.
And as a couple, that strengthens the relationship from that point of view, obviously.
We love weird stuff. That's why we travel. That's what we want to see, is like the weird. We went to New York. We were like, what can we do in New York that would be wild? Like, what is weird in New York?
Because I've been to New York many times, but Holly had been denied the opportunity to go to New York many times. So we're about equal, as the amount of times I'd been was the amount of times that Holly had not been able to go to New York.
Failed trips to New York.
So many.
Flights booked and no... It's been a nightmare, but we got there.
So when it came to the honeymoon, I was like, Holly, what do you want to see? What do you want to do? What do you want to find?
And so I went absolutely mental on Pinterest. Wild on Pinterest. I was like, what's weird there? And I was like... looking for foods, I was like, I've seen these, like, you know, like unicorn pull-apart cheese toasties and things. I was like, yeah, that's like okay, but like, let's see if we can find something more interesting. And we found a restaurant in the Upper West Side that served pickle soft serve, and it was incredible. Absolute trek to get to. It was such a long way to get to. But it was amazing.
Sort of got lost on the way there. We sort of just went for a walk, and we found a nice bookshop, and we found a nice cafe, and all these things sort of flow into one. And then it was like, oh my goodness, that's the place we're looking for. Pickle soft serve time.
From the UK, how much of Brexit was the reason for you leaving?
It was a pretty strong reason we left.
Because setting up gigs within Europe is going to become harder, I would assume.
Yeah, and we sort of just got the company to a point where we were starting to make European gigs. We'd sort of built up to a point where we were starting to get international gigs, we were starting to get international interest, and it was something we wanted to keep pursuing. But there was a combination of such low wages in the UK, combined with, I have dual citizenship with Germany, so I was living in the UK as a German citizen. It was very, very unclear, because I hadn't been there for 5 years, whether I would be allowed to stay. It was sort of, if you'd been there 5 years, you're all good, don't worry about it. If you're under 5 years, we don't know yet. And
honestly, we're still not sure.
I've applied for what I can apply for, and we have to hope that I can be granted some form of permanency at the end of it.
Will you be German Australian or German UK or try?
You're not allowed to be German British.
No, so like I'm already under a sort of a loophole with Germany to be a dual citizen. They don't particularly like dual citizens in the first place. I fell into a gap in the law that worked in my favour, which has been wonderful. It also makes for very confusing travel, because I'm constantly flipping passports and...
So in answer to my question, you're heading towards German-Australian.
I think it would take a lot for you to...
lose Australian.
Lose your German.
Oh, to lose my German. Oh, yeah,
I don't think it would be worthwhile.
No, I think it's beneficial for me
UK
to maintain.
UK sounding very untenable. From your point of view, Holly, you're probably more tied to the UK?
Yeah, so I don't think I would ever ditch my UK passport, and I'm not a citizen here yet. I think we are heading in the direction of that. I think that would be a sensible life choice. But I think realistically...
You'll have to do it on the 26th of January. They're moving it all to the 26th of January now. So if you want to recognise that day...
Get a little flag.
Don't
become an Australian.
Don't be that British, Holly. Don't be that British.
It was hard to leave the UK on those terms. So when we left, it was supposed to be... around the date that it was meant to happen.
Mm.
And they obviously moved it forward because that's what they did with it a million times. And British politics. The feeling in the UK over the last, I don't know when the vote was, 3 years ago, four years ago?
Who knows how long ago it was.
Has been so, it's abrasive, isn't it? It's hard to talk to anyone. And like, you'll have a conversation with someone, you'll be like, I know that what I'm saying is right. I know that I'm saying I want to stay in Europe because then my husband can live here and that's important to me, and like, it's important to me that I've got free travel, and it's important to me, like, these things are things that mean a lot to me,
and it's important for him, as in you, in terms of having your production company to actually achieve the goals in the name of the UK if they wanted it.
Yeah, exactly.
So to have people come at you with the opposite opinion, especially if they're people that, like, family members or friends and things like that, it's hard to not be angry. Really makes me angry.
We had a really strange experience with some neighbours at the time. Once again, our beautiful two-bedroom mid-terrace house. We were in a little cul-de-sac, and it was beautiful, and we had a lot of elderly neighbours, and we were invited around for Christmas the year that it happened, the vote happened. And we were sort of talking to them, and I was saying, like, I'm living here on a German passport, I'm an immigrant, it's really tough for me, and I think what I see as an immigrant is I know a lot of other immigrants, and we're all working hard. The thing is, we're not just working a day job, all of us are here because we have some other dream that we're trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. So while I sit and watch a lot of people go to work every day, I sit and watch a lot of immigrants go to work every day, but then go home and
hustle
really hard. And so when I hear people with rhetoric that's sort of like, oh, immigrants are, you know, not good people and all these kind of things, it's really tough to hear. And we were at this Christmas dinner party, and the lovely elderly lady next to me turns to me and goes, don't call yourself that. I said, what? And she's like, don't call yourself an immigrant. You're not one of those. And I thought, no, I'm exactly an immigrant. I live, in fact, honestly,
the Collins Dictionary. Yeah.
I'm actually probably
German passport.
Yeah, I'm actually probably the worst kind, because like, I have literally found a loophole that I'm able to live in the UK. Like, I'm probably, like, I am your worst nightmare.
Mm.
I'm glad it's over. And it was funny, when we moved out here, we sort of like, quite often will drop off social media. Personally, we'll be pushing the company, but we'll personally step off things if certain news topics become too much.
Yes.
What I didn't realize was, after I came out here, it wasn't as big a deal as what it is obviously in the UK. It's not an every moment of every day kind of issue out here. And as such, I was flicking on Twitter just one day randomly, and I just felt this wave of anxiety come over me and stress. And I thought, is this what I was living like for the past 3-4 years under this sort of oppressive feeling of anxiety, because I was at any moment felt like I could be kicked out and not welcomed back.
I am hearing a lot about artists who had those big plans of doing the UK, Europe, musicians, for example.
Yeah.
No longer.
And vice versa too. I know so many Europeans that are trying to work out what it's going to be to come into the UK, and they're now talking about you're going to only be able to get limited time visas and these kind of things, and that's not productive for people that are wanting to tour for a long period of time. Like, the UK does have a fantastic touring market. There's so many towns that you can go and play. For that to suddenly be cut off to so many people is disappointing on so many levels.
We're currently in conversation with Sean and Holly Brymore of Brymore Productions. You've both chosen to be children's performers, and I learned earlier this evening from your chat with Peter Gers on ABC Radio Adelaide that it's because both your parents are children's performers.
Well, our parents work in schools. Holly's mum's a teacher, and my mum's an integration aide. And my mum has always sort of turned to me and said, oh, I wish you'd put your theatre into working with children that have special needs and those kind of things.
She's Which, like, is what an integration aide does.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So mum's always sort of been encouraging me of that, but I've never felt like that's the way I wanted to go down in life. You know, that wasn't the career path for me. I wanted to be producing, I wanted to be doing musical theatre, I wanted to be doing those kind of things. Children's theatre came about randomly. When we left Australia, I didn't want to be a producer anymore. We thought, what do we do now? Holly said, take a break. And so I did, but I'm not very good at breaks. The minute I sort of stopped thinking about being a producer, this idea came to me for a children's theatre character, and we started developing it from there. And my big thing was that we didn't have the finances to sort of stage a show with it, so we made a podcast about this character. It was called Mortimer Sparks, Adventures in Imagination. Mm-hmm. And it was this
radio play, interactive
experimentation, really. And it worked. We got onto the iTunes New and Noteworthy charts with it, but it became too hard to make because it was a very, because there was a lot of sound effects, a lot of music, those kind of things. It was quite labor intensive, but it proved to us that this character would work and that people were interested in it. And maybe, even though I hadn't performed in a long time, maybe something would work.
And I think equally that character sparked the thing that I think is the most prevalent in our work, which is children's ideas are 100% of what we do. So everything that we do comes from an idea from a child, and that children should be given the space to be able to give ideas and for people to be like, you're right. Mm. Like, if you say a green monkey from Mars went to Coles, you're absolutely correct, he did. And that, I think, is the thing that really started
validating the creative mind that they have.
Yeah.
And through that, getting the answer of what might be true or not. But that doesn't matter because it's the creative process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to pick up on something that Tom Hanks was saying to Alan Alda. Too often adults, that'd be us, say to a kid, how was your day? What are you doing? Blah, 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 blah. And just like overloading them with all these questions and then expecting them to go, oh, and they don't.
Yeah.
But what we should be saying is, that's a lovely green jacket, and then be quiet.
Mm.
And then it's up to the kid to decide if they say, well, yes, it is.
Yeah.
Or, oh, well, this green jacket I got at a market one day and I was down in the forest and the forest did this. And the importance of listening to the children.
Our work is primarily improvised, and the rules of improvisation are listening as like the key number one thing. It's so important to listen to the information provided because that creates the work, that sets the scene, that does everything. What we learned very fast was, coming from a world where we didn't make children's theatre into a world where we do, was that there are just these brilliant ideas and they're so pure.
And genius.
Yeah. They're more creative by far than
me.
Anything really that we could come up with. And it's, as an adult, we lose this sense of fun and play and these wonderful things that children have. What kind of a world would we be in if everyone was a bit more playful and enjoyed things a bit more and had that childlike view of the world? It's always interesting to hear what a child thinks of something that they see. And, you know, you might be at the zoo or something and standing with an animal and the child doesn't notice that it's a rhino that they're looking at. They'll be like, oh, there's like a bug on this plant.
They're like,
over
look,
here.
That window's round.
Yeah, and that is fascinating. What has made that child interested in that thing there? Even like when we have ideas thrown up. You know, the other day we had at our first Holden Street performance, there was one child said tiger, and then one person said shark, and then one child said tiger shark kind of thing. And I thought, what is going on in that kid's head that specific animal is like the thing that they want to talk about? Like, that is the, when you say like, what's your favorite animal? And they go, it's a really specific animal kind of thing. And you go, that's amazing. I love that. I used to do some tours in a garden in the UK, some private garden tours. And there was a boy that came on one of the tours and he was on the autism spectrum, but he was very, very, very knowledgeable about fossils. And he lived on the south coast of the UK and he went fossil hunting. And he didn't just go, Holly and I went fossil hunting once. It was very casual.
We bought the hammer, we bought the backpack.
Yeah. It was an enjoyable day. We weren't very good at it. This kid, I noticed him like chucking something in his hand. I'm like, what's that? And he's like, it's a plesiosaur spinal cord piece. And I said, how on earth did you get that? He's like, I found it. And he goes on these like professional adult fossil hunting things. And it's because his parents have recognized that here is something that he is very passionate about and very focused on. He is fascinated by this. And he's fascinated to the point where he has become a professional basically in his field. And that is wonderful.
But it's also the fact that he had the creativity in his mind to make the stories relevant.
Yeah.
So whilst, here's the facts, it's a fossil, it's this, you can look it up, but he had to start from a creative point in the first point.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
To actually want to go out and discover.
And want to know more.
And I think kids are, when I was a kid, I was really into the movie Anastasia, but I think all kids have like that one thing that is their thing. And when you find that thing and when you give them space to be like, I'm listening to you, what you say to me is important, and when they say like, this is the thing that I want to hear about, this is the thing that I want to see, this is my thing, and then you say yes,
you watch them open up,
mind blown,
everything flows out.
It's an idea in their head, but what you're able to do as actors actors, character actors as that, is to actually articulate their thoughts.
Yeah.
It's a 3D dream.
Yeah, sort of. And, I think some of the things we create are really weird and wild and wacky and unpredictable. And that's the joy in it. It's not necessarily their full idea, but it'll be a few kids' ideas together, amalgamated, and it forms this one weird conglomeration of thing.
Yeah.
And that is weird and exciting, and they enjoy that because it is sort of in their head. They have these weird visions and thoughts and crazy ideas. And when they realize they have control over where the show goes and can like help us, the end of the show is we try to make the greatest story of all time. And we basically start off this piece by saying, we're not authors, so you're going to need to help us.
We can't write the story, yeah.
Even though we started off and we do what an author does, but then we get to certain points and we just go like, I don't know what happens now. And we just hand it over. And you watch these kids go like, this is what's going to happen next. The giant meatball is going to like take over the town. And you're like, Of course it is. Yeah. Duh, that was the only way it could have gone.
Yeah.
And it's so fun, like, then bringing that to life and seeing what a giant meatball taking over the town is like.
Giving the child the responsibility and the trust.
Totally. And I think that they thrive on that. So we say, like, we can't do this on our own. We do not have the skills to make this happen without you. So you are... you are the key piece here, so we need you. And I think the build-up of the show and we kind of ease them in to start with, and we gain their trust, and then they kind of realize that they're the key piece, they're the key player, and that they are in charge of kind of what's going on.
The excitement you both get in seeing the lights in their eyes.
I feel like 90% of my show is watching faces. So I'm like 10% of the time doing the show, but 90% of the time I'm making sure that every single person in the room is engaged and is in it and is completely on board with what's happening. And it is kind of after the first bit that we do. So we do, it's like a word fill, for lack of a better term.
So, for example, number and between 1 and 10, they have to figure out that it's 8.
Yeah, yeah, and they sort of fill the blanks in it.
And then the next one is, okay, what would you find in a garden? Well, gate would rhyme with 8, so...
Yeah, yeah, all those kind of things.
And when we get through that, usually we've got them. They're all in, and sometimes kids will come up at the end and they'll say to us, like, I cannot believe that we got every single one of those words right. I cannot believe that the words were giraffe, cheese... socks, Mickey Mouse, and you'd be like, I know, I can't believe it. And it could be any word. It could have been apple, banana.
But it's about giving them their story and that responsibility and trust.
Yeah,
that
totally.
You will accept whatever they say.
Yeah,
and they believe it, and they're like, oh, I was right. And when you get them there, you're done.
They're in. They're hooked.
You're golden.
They think that the world is real. And we make the world as real as possible for them. And that you can see it. You watch them. It's like you were saying, that moment where their eyes light up. We did a show where we were the Explorer character that we mentioned earlier, when that turned into a full show. Then we did a festival roaming piece with it. And we did an act. He was an Explorer character, but he was a bumbling idiot. One piece we had was he was carrying around a giant stone tablet with a whole lot of ancient symbols on it, tripped over, fell, smashed it into pieces. And the only issue with putting it back together was he didn't speak the language that it was written on. So he needed the kids, who were obviously experts in the field, to put it back together. And we had this wonderful interaction one day where these children, and they were just random nonsense symbols that might look a bit like something, a bit like a Rorschach test. You know, you go like, oh yeah, that's a butterfly or whatever. And these kids completely found, you know, whatever they thought these items were. And then we retold a story together, putting them in order of the things that they'd picked out. These kids just went like, that's exactly what I said it was. I can't believe it was what I said it was. They were so in the world that they could not comprehend
that we would have made that up.
It was exactly what the stone said.
The cynical side of me looks at parenthood and goes, if only they'd read to their kids. If only when they read to the kid says, as you were saying before, oh, look at the flower in the corner, which isn't part of the story.
Yeah.
And then talk about that flower for a while.
Yeah.
I feel that not enough parents are doing that. What's your feeling as children performers? Is enough of that going on?
I mean, every child that comes into our show even if the parents don't think they're a creative child, and even if that's not happening at home, the kid has it in them. The parents will sometimes say, like, oh, we won't be able to do this, or, oh, yeah, this isn't really his thing, or, you know, he won't be able to come up with anything. And then they do, and you watch their faces go like, oh my gosh, my child's a genius. It's such like a satisfying feeling to be like, your kid's creative because every kid is creative. Like, celebrate what they know and what is fun for them.
Which is a way more positive way of saying what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Is that it's just, I spend all day seeing parents on their phones and the kids are looking up at the parent going, talk to me. And I'm there going, I wish you were being read a book.
I mean, one of the reasons we started doing this kind of work was we just kept seeing kids on iPads in pushes in shopping centres. And I thought, what does this world become if these children are playing with apps that really have one designated outcome? No matter what these apps, how much flexibility you have in these apps, really, there's no unlimited creative output to that. There is always one answer at the end of the day. Are we going to lose creativity in a generation of kids because they haven't been taught or haven't learned or haven't been immersed in a world that encourages them to be imaginative and creative?
You do a bug show.
This piece is called A Bugs Party, and we developed it in conjunction with an art centre called The Spring over in the UK. They do an annual family festival where they go out into the community and do pop-up events in community spaces. And the whole idea of it is it's like an informal drop-in, drop-out session. So you've got to be able to develop a piece of work that can go for approximately between 2 and 4 hours a day. And at any point, someone could come in and have a play or do something, but have a complete experience within a very long period of time. But it's self-driven almost.
So there's a number of different stations across a room, for example.
Exactly. Yeah, but then we also culminate every so often. This is how we did it anyway. You would then culminate together and share a group experience as well. So that one started off with, when the children walked into the space, the idea was that we were bugs. It was the Queen Bee's birthday party. We were royal helper bees.
It was sort of a Regency-esque themed
Garden party
inside in winter.
Yep, and the idea was that these kids would walk into the space and they'd be shrunk down to the size of bugs. So everything all the props we designed and made, it was like oversized crayons made out of pool noodles and giant mud birthday cake that they could play with, and all these things were scaled up to make them feel like they were tiny bugs. And they entered the space and it was a mess. These two helper bees were frantic because it was a mess and the queen was going to come, and how could we have a good birthday for her if the queen was going to come and it was a mess? And it was this whole idea of playing with these kids cleaning up and then, in essence, making a mess again. And it was really funny watching, because this was a real learning experience for us. There are kids that are cleaners and there are kids that are mess makers.
Yeah.
And they're not mutually exclusive. We would watch one child chuck petals out of a bucket and one child walk behind and sweep them back up.
And they loved it. He wasn't annoyed
that he
had to sweep up the petals. He was so thrilled.
So creatively they knew their role.
Yeah, they were like, I know what's going on here. My job is the sweeper.
And it's funny, his mother was like following around packing up. I was like, I sort of approached her and sort of semi out of character was like, you know, you don't need to clean up. It's okay. It's part of the act. And she's like, honestly, just to see him cleaning stuff up is like a really good thing right now. She's like, hopefully you can take that back to the bedroom and, like, you know, make sure that his bedroom's tidy after this. That'd be a wonderful takeaway from this experience.
And the other parents just pulling their hair out.
Yeah,
going,
totally.
He's a petal thrower.
It was really funny though, because the show ended with the queen didn't come because it was just us. We couldn't bring in a queen character. So it was just us, and we sort of got to the end and we were like, I'm sorry guys, but the queen's not coming. Let's make a mess. That wasn't a good enough answer for a number of children. It was fine for like 95% of the audience.
Uh-oh.
But there was at least two kids every time that went home distraught. And that was a learning experience as well, is that if you are building for a payoff, that payoff has to come in some shape or form, and you can't leave, because it makes me sad that we let children go unhappy.
As production team of this kind of creativity, what is the response from schools and teachers? How do you find that?
We are very lucky that we are in the position we are in with our family. So my mum and my sister are both primary school teachers. So my sister teaches 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, something like that. And my mum teaches 4-year-olds. And so we can go into them and be like, if we do this, this, and this, is that going to work in a school environment? And they can be like, yes or no.
And then we can play with it and experiment. Usually we try a lot of the work with those schools to try and put it in front of an audience and get an idea of, is this going to work or is it not going to work? That's a very fantastic asset that we have.
I'm now imagining, if you come back to Australia and base yourself here, you could be touring around Australian schools for part of the year.
Yeah, yeah.
And that might be your thing. Am I speaking out of turn?
No, no. The reason we actually came back here and pushed to get Holly her visa was because we'd been picked up for a regional Queensland school tour. We came out here to do that.
Now, for international listeners, regional Queensland is a pretty big place.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of work to do there.
We were sort of lucky we were primarily on the coast. We didn't have to go like 24 hours into, you know, the middle of...
Yeah, but the experience of doing that as well would be great.
Yeah, and incredible. It was such a diverse range of students. And we sort of, to be honest, to be frank, we had a lot of preconceptions about what that was going to be like. And I suppose, like, as a Melbournean, I have a lot of preconceptions as to what other aspects or other places of Australia are going to be like. It was really surprising and heartwarming.
The kids were... so clever.
It was really funny watching the difference between a like closer to the capital, so like closer to Brisbane audience, compared to an audience further out. You watched sort of that opening act we do in this show is where we gather things. One of the questions we ask is, name a job. And at one school, like sort of the inner city one, it was like, glass blower. And we're like, all right.
Great job.
And then when we were out in the country, it was like, it's a farmer or it's a miner or these kind of things. And we're like, that's fine. But then on the flip side, that was that one. And we were sort of like, okay. But on the flip side, then the guys in the country would almost be more clever because I have a feeling they sort of are on the tech a lot less, gauging in outdoor activities and
which gets back to my other point about the actual play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was very revealing. And I think we had some of those regional schools, we had more fun in those ones than we do sometimes in cities.
Back in my day, and we're not too dissimilar, I would think, you'd just be sent out the door at like 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and it's like, I'll see you at 6 tonight.
Back when the sun sets.
When sun sets, come back on in.
Yeah.
That's you. That's like you talk about it all the time.
Yeah. Right. Send me out on my bike. Off I go. I grew up in, I think the word is Hamlet. It was barely a village. Smallest little collection of houses you've ever seen, and there was a park down the end of my road, and then the forest, the New Forest, was next to that. So we knew we weren't to go to the forest. We knew that we weren't to go like into the forest, so we could like play by the forest and we could like push the envelope a little bit there and go a little bit in. We're like, ooh, we're a bit far in here, but we would just like play all day, and it would be on our bikes, or it'd be on the swings, or we'd be playing the way that we do. We'd be making up stories and we'd be acting things out.
I lived, I guess it was semi-rural as a child, but we had a lot of land. My sister and I would play outdoors quite often, play indoors quite often. We have a pretty sizable house in that sense. We would put on shows in the living room and charge tickets and, you know, all these kind of things. And play was such a big part of my childhood. And I remember once we have a lake or a dam in the middle of the property, and I had a friend from primary school over one day, and I told him, apparently, this is the story I've heard, there's a monster in the lake, you know, a lake monster, a Loch Ness kind of thing, I guess. And he sort of went out to his mum, who was sitting with my mum having a coffee, and he's like, oh, Sean's telling me that there's a monster in the lake. And he was quite distraught and upset. And his mum was just like, oh, Sean's just being silly. Like, there's no monster out there. And I think this goes back to the heart of what we do, is that we are telling children, yes, there is a monster out there.
In the lake.
We believe you. Where, if we believe you, where do we go from there? What's next? What does the monster do? Is it a cool monster? Is it a fun monster? Is it a scary monster?
Does it have monster friends?
And that opens a whole new world. Whereas you've got that other experience, is that child had a no, that child had a shutdown. It's improvisation basic law. It's the yes and. Yes, there is a monster. What's the monster like? That mother was like, no, there's not a monster. So we couldn't play that game anymore. Mm. That was it. We had to do something else.
Based upon that, where are we going with children's imaginations?
We have to find ways to engage them. If we're moving into a heavier tech world, I think we have to be creating apps that can have a
genuine sense of
creativity and imagination usage, because otherwise we're just didactically telling children things.
But as you said before, there is such limitation within that.
Mm.
So do you find some sense of hope that there is going to be the investment or the push forward to make it a more creative sphere?
I was just thinking off the top of my head, and I was thinking about a friend of ours and their son, the father and the son, they play Minecraft together, of sort of Lego building and then exploring the world you've Lego built and being able to interact with the world you've Lego built. And that is the kind of thing I think we need. If we're going down a tech road, what are these worlds where, if we're playing video games, how do we make them creative?
Mm.
The difference between a walk around and shoot things game versus a game like The Sims, where you can create an experience, create a world, not be limited, that's where we sort of need
it's
to be heading down if we're going tech way.
Talk to us a little bit more about the father-son experience and what you saw there.
They're a wonderful family in general.
They do a beautiful job of raising him.
They're always taking him to the zoo and engaging museums and all sorts of things, and really getting him involved in nature and all sorts of things. So they're teaching him a lot of wonderful things.
And he's very polite, he's very well spoken, he's very interested in a lot of things, and he's willing to learn. And I think that is something that they have instilled in him. So he's homeschooled and he has had that instilled in him. It's like, education is fun, and the things that we're teaching you are things that you can use in other things. And I'm going to teach you history, but I'm going to teach you history through this, and I'm going to teach you maths through this. And like, the world that they build for him is so creative, and I think that's such a honourable thing to do.
A lot of parents don't have that
option. Yeah.
And what both of you can do as creatives is to actually inject yourselves at the point of their lives to actually make them think differently.
I think if we can spark something, if we can spark an interest, if we can spark a curiosity, if we can spark creativity, and that's sort of at the end of the show, you know, we're doing this call out for, a call to action is almost what it is at the end of the show, is to get kids to create and share stories in whatever way they feel comfortable doing it. We do it by goofing around on stage, incredibly physically, weird accents, the works. But if they want to write, if they want to draw, if they want to interpretive dance, whatever it takes to get them creating and doing things, and that's why we're now trying to collect 1,000 stories, because we want them to have an outlet for it. You know, I think kids are constantly creating stuff, and maybe the epitome of what you can achieve is a spot on the fridge. How can we get kids another avenue that their works can be shared?
Let's talk about those 1,000 stories that they're submitting through the process of what you're doing. A book is the outcome, is my understanding. What kind of book would that be?
I suppose it's going to depend on what we get. So, for example, when we were in Perth, we received a wonderful hand-illustrated selection of about 5 A4 pages of story, and it was wonderful. And that suddenly then, in my head, goes, oh boy, this sort of is different to what I was expecting to receive.
What were you expecting?
I don't know. To be honest, I'm
not entirely sure. Were you expecting, like, little pictures, like a couple of words?
Maybe some pictures, maybe some words.
Voice messages?
Yeah, I mean, the response now is that we will, and I don't know how we 100% facilitate all these different methods, but we have to sort of stay on top of it as well and try and work it out now too. Because at the moment, the website is set up basically to take text submissions, but if people come to the show, they can obviously give us things in person, and things change that way. Is it a book in the end? I mean, that's sort of, when we set out, we thought, this is probably the easiest way of doing it. We know how to self-publish things. We've done some scripts and things in the past. We thought maybe it'd tack onto the back of, say, the bureau script. We've sort of updated the bureau script a bit. Maybe it'll go in the back of that. But now, as we get these submissions, we have to sort of change our thinking about what is the best way of presenting these works, and in a way that they can be enjoyed by other people and continue to inspire other kids. I don't know what the end result is going to be. I don't even know if we expected that we would get to 1,000 stories necessarily. And even if we don't, I think what is submitted is incredibly special. And how we ensure that that feeling translates to an audience.
When that child gave me that story, I was so humbled by the fact that she had spent all of that time doing that, and that she was giving it to me to keep. I was like, wow, that's really good. And I like gave it back to her, And she was like, no, that's for you. And I was like, it was like a 5-10 page A4. And I was like, you've put this time and this effort, and you trust me to hold this for you. That's so humbling as well.
That so brings up for me the art of letter writing and things like that, where it's just like a gift. It is, I'm going to spend the time. Getting back to Tom Hanks, he was talking about the typewriter, actually typing out a letter.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not the ink, it's the impressions on the paper that you're giving to someone else.
Yeah.
How heavy, how soft.
I think it's that trust thing that we were talking about before. The trust that I'm going to look at that and say, that's important and that's good. I'm so grateful that you have made that and you've brought that to me, and that they're trusting us with their story and that they're giving us that as you say, as a gift, as a thing that I've created, and I want you to look after it for me.
What we're not seeing with the iPads and everything else is the sticking of the stick figure on the fridge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm now, just as we're discussing this, sort of reflecting on all the things I've created over the years as a child and those kind of things. And, you know, Mum's got boxes of them in the house. Mum and Dad have boxes of them in the house. And I'm sure I can find a bunch of them. And I'm sure we've recently, in moving back down to the basement, found them and had a look through them and had a laugh. But at the same time, they are a really important element of history and being. We are what we create in that essence. I think Holly is totally right in that I didn't necessarily give these out to anyone. Like, I made a whole lot of comic books in high school that we had a laugh about around the classroom, and then I took them home with me, kind of thing. And they're still in a folder in the house. But I made them to make my friends laugh and for them to enjoy. And we do make things not just for ourselves, but for others to enjoy. That's why we make the theatre.
Mm.
That's why the kids draw the pictures. It's an expression. It's something that should be treasured. So whether it's parents sticking pictures up on fridges or encouraging their children to take up opportunities or encouraging them to be creative in whatever aspect, that expression is so important.
Those moments I'm thinking where a parent puts the arm around the child to just help with the crayon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that goes back to our friends playing Minecraft. It doesn't have to be a picture. Take that time to sit with your child and do something creative with them and be blown away. Like we mentioned earlier, these parents that are blown away when they think, my child can't do this, and then they are proven that, oh, my child actually can do this. I've never experienced them doing this before. This is really special.
For you two, the theatre itself has become the creation of a story, drawing both of you together. Do you get that sense that you are creating a history together based through the theatre that you do?
I think before Holly, I had an idea of what I wanted in my head, an idea of what I thought my life was going to turn out like, and it definitely did not involve children's theatre. But Holly coming into my world has changed it entirely, and changed it entirely for the positive. What we are creating is now really important work.
Mm.
And when I was younger and doing other things, I didn't realise the importance that children's theatre can have.
Did you have someone hold your hand during those younger years through those experiences you were saying in terms of the father-son Minecraft? Did you have those?
Oh, for sure. 100%. I have the most wonderfully supportive parents, which has been, and they continue to be the most wonderfully supportive parents, and that has made a whole lot of difference.
So you can recognise the hand-holding, the embracing of the creative as you now do.
100%. Totally.
From those days.
Yes.
And equally, I think our parents collectively come from a whole world of careers.
Yeah.
So Sean's dad is a patisserie chef and Sean's mum works in schools. My mum, before she was a teacher, was an engineer. She used to be a plane engineer.
How early were those mornings, Sean? Patisserie bakeries, 4 a.m.?
My dad would be at work before I would wake up in the morning, kind of thing.
Sorry, Holly.
My dad was a postman when I was growing up, so he was back from work by the time I woke up.
Yeah.
And I think that because we have that broad selection of, like, these are all creative things and these are all impressive and these are all good and these are all, and like, I don't know about you, but my parents were always trying things. So like, my parents would like make clubs and they'd they'd go out and they'd do things and they'd try things and they'd do a lot of things. And not all of them were the right thing. Not all of them were the thing that was like the thing. But watching them do that was like, oh, okay, I can do a million things. And like, I don't need to be like, this is my career path, this is what I'm going to do. Which meant that when I fell into children's theatre, it was like, okay, let's see how this goes. And it's the same with, I've done every job under the sun. It is all creative. And if you do it with passion and you do it with pride, then everything is a creative experience.
Well, talking about the creative process, does it keep you up at night that you want to do so much? Or how does the creative process live within each of you?
There's never enough time. And I think some of the greatest minds in the world have said that. Walt Disney...
not to tear in a trumpet there.
No, I'm not, I don't want to say I'm Walt Disney, but, you know, even more recently, Lin-Manuel Miranda from Hamilton and in the Heights before fame. That. These are people that there's constantly something going on. There is a certain subsect of people, I think, that have that going on, that there is not enough time. There is never going to be enough time. And progressively, I think, we want more.
And it's like, we were so busy with this. We were so busy, like, booking shows and booking festivals and filling our year, and then we were like, let's do a podcast. It was a bold move,
but we did it. And there's always something else to work on. There's always another idea. There's always a new show coming up. There's always something is happening to keep us engaged and using our imaginations, I guess, as well.
How you actually manage that from a grassroots really point of view as well.
So I saw in a video once that you don't get given a chair at the table. You need to bring your own chair to the table, and that's how you get things done. We so heavily operate on that. And like, if we have to be up till 3 o'clock in the morning making calls, filling out spreadsheets, emailing this person, emailing that person,
sewing the groin of a reindeer puppet
at 3 a.m.
we're there. We're
you know
doing it.
If that's what it needs to be, that's what it needs to be. But that's the thing, is like, we hustle so hard.
Well, hey, this is Jeremy Neal, and I'm coming up on Radio Notes, talk all about life and my new album, We Were Trying to Make It Out.
Sean and Holly join us from Brightmore Productions. You mentioned musical theatre before Holly came along.
Mm-hmm.
Musical theatre was your thing?
Not from a performance perspective.
But from a production point of view.
I cannot sing or dance. I sort of learnt at university or TAFE. Acting and singing and dancing was probably not going to be my thing, so I needed another avenue, and producing seemed to be the way to go.
Were you drawn to the musical production side?
I guess I'd always been interested in musicals as a kid. My parents would take me to shows in Melbourne. My earliest memories of the theatre are not the show, but like just being in the State Theatre and the plush red velvet and the brass banisters and those kind of things. And that feeling was like, wow, this is what a cool place. And we'd dress up for it. It was a special outing, and we'd go like once a year. It was a really special experience like that. What's wonderful is that it is an experience that I continue to share with my parents. Now, before we did this children's theatre, I did produce a number of shows. I co-produced the Australasian premiere of a little musical called Title of Show, which was on Broadway in 2008. Helped transfer it out here in 2010. That musical means a lot to me.
Why does it mean so much?
It was about two guys writing a show about two guys writing a show. It's very meta. It was four people and a keyboard on a Broadway stage, which is significant because that's not how the business is done. It's a full orchestra and it's chorus numbers and it's dropping chandeliers and that kind of thing. And here was a show that spoke about being an artist and the struggles of being an artist and the joys of being an artist and the friendship that you get from it. Here it was, and they were four people playing themselves, and they took the show from a festival, much like one of the fringe festivals, and they took it off Broadway and then they took it onto Broadway. And that was what they sort of said at the start of the show they were going to do. And by the end of the show, you've actually watched it get there. And if you were lucky enough to see it on Broadway, it was on Broadway. Recently, they did a reunion for 10 years, and we were there during our honeymoon to see it, which is a very special experience. And what was especially special to me was that I reached out to one of the cast members and the writer, because they had their email addresses on their blog at the time.
Rookie move.
I was like, I'm going to send an email. And it's like, when I read back on it now, it's like 18, and it's like, oh my God, I love you guys. I'm fangirling like crazy. But I was like, I'm going to get an automated response saying like, thank you for reaching out to a Title Love show. And instead, Jeff Bowen, the composer, emailed me and said, Sean, it is so nice to hear from you. I think I'd asked if I could be the number one Australian fan. And he said, look, someone's fighting over the title in New Zealand, but Australia's wide open at the moment, so why not? Go for it. And from that, that's when I started to create these wild YouTube shows with Jared, my friend. And we were like, well, if they're going to Broadway, we're going to go to Broadway to see them on Broadway. And it became this like odyssey. And we suddenly were like friends with these guys. And when we got there, they took us out for dinner one night. And it was this wild experience that started happening and connected me with a whole lot of people in America. And from that point on, my life's been very weird and strange. And it's all because of that show. And when we produced it in Melbourne, three of the guys came out to see it. The director, Michael Bress, has been an incredible supporter of everything I've done from that moment on. And bringing Holly into the fold became an incredible supporter of what we do together and us as a couple. He was one of our groomsmen at the wedding. It's been this really special friendship, mentorship, I guess, in a sense, and supportive
group. I think it's an aspirational thing to see as well for us, especially at this point in our career. And I don't think this is where it begun, but it's got to a point now where it's like they started that show at the New York
Music Theatre Festival, yeah,
and then it grew and it grew and it grew and it's grown, and there's nothing in the world that says that you can't do that. No one is stopping you from just hustling and doing it.
Holly, musical theatre for you, what was your first introduction with it?
I saw...
Not a great experience?
Excellent experience.
See, when the English go, ugh.
So the first time I went to the theatre, I actually saw a ballet. I saw Coppelia when I was like six, seven. And then my mum and my grandma took me to see Starlight Express on tour.
It wasn't so popular down in Australia.
Let me tell you what, Starlight Express is incredible.
Yeah, well, okay. You know, she's got opinions.
They've got rollerblades. They're all trained.
They're in space. You know,
the target audience of Starlight Express as an 8-year-old.
It's a smash hit in Germany with a custom theatre, but you know, whatever. Yeah,
I loved
not a weird
it.
Show at all.
I had to play that on clarinet. So.
What a dream.
It would only be any better if it was recorder.
Maybe it was recorder.
I couldn't play recorder when I was a kid, but I was in the recorder band. I'm rubbish at playing music, and I love music, but I can't. I have no sense of rhythm. I have no pitch. I can't do it. So I was in the recorder band, and it was me and one other girl playing this recorder solo, and I didn't know how to play the recorder, so I was just like doing the fingers and pretending to. But there were two of us, so it was like...
But that's why it was a solo and not a duet. Yeah.
No, it was a bold move on my part. And I did it to, like, I was, like, 10 or 11. And no one was like, Holly, I've noticed that you actually can't play the recorder. What are you still doing here? But good times.
Take us back to Starlight Express, then.
I'd love to.
I'm sorry for all the listeners you are going to lose through this podcast.
So thank you for staying with us. we're now going to talk about Starlight Express. What was it about Starlight Express, Holly?
I had obviously never seen anything like that. And as like your first thing, it's like, what is this mayhem? Like, they are singing, they're alive. It was 3D. They gave you 3D glasses. I cannot believe what I am experiencing right now. I cannot believe that this is what's happening in the costumes and the songs and the, like, there was this massive, massive cast for a touring production, and they'd like put the ramps up around the stage in this theatre, and I was like, this is incredible. Like, what a world.
Did you take up rollerblading?
I had rollerblades, and I gave it a solid go.
What music... Let's stay with Holly for a moment. Yeah, what music were you listening to at the time?
Oh, S Club. What was I listening to?
Oh, come on, Mika's got to be coming up soon.
No, that was much later. Okay. So I was like, we were like a Wham household. So it would have been like Wham, it would have been Aha. We found out the other day. So me and my siblings, I've got an older sister and a younger brother. There's 6 years in us. And my sister's name is Anna, and my brother's name is Adam. And literally this year we were like, our names spell Aha. And my mum was like, that wasn't on purpose. And we were like, it definitely seems like it was on purpose, doesn't it?
If kids don't use their imaginations when life gets tough during puberty, then they don't get through some things.
No, that's a big thing.
Why have I got these hairy bits?
Yeah.
Oh, it's because I'm this. If you can't have the imagination to make up a story that's going to get you through.
Yeah, that's...
I think imagination is the thing that gets you through a lot of things, especially if, like, times are hard. It's the feeling of like, I can do and be anything and I can achieve the world.
So it was the sort of 80s pop that was getting you through.
Oh yeah, that was like the ABBA. We had ABBA Gold on VHS and I would watch that a lot. And then my mum had Kate Bush Best Of on VHS and I would literally watch Kate Bush Best Of every day.
And that's why we do weird things now on stage, because you just watch so much Kate Bush
Big Bubble, and I like push out the bubble and then I've got the light and I'm swinging the light and I am Kate Bush.
Sean, what was informing you during those younger into teenage years?
My family listened to a lot of like The Four Seasons, Herman's Hermits. I listened to a lot of Herman's Hermits as a child. When we used to go on road trips, Herman's Hermits was like the album. Best Of Herman's Hermits. We would listen to that in the car on long car trips. That was like my jam. And it's funny, I was thinking we met at a Beatles tribute concert, but really as a child, my family, I don't think, listened to a lot of the Beatles, but like listened to a lot of like Paul McCartney, Wings. Band on the Run is like one of my like top albums. If Desert Island Disc kind of thing, I would take that with me because it's like the first thing I bought on vinyl for myself when I had a record player kind of thing. When I found it, I was like, yes!
First thing you bought on vinyl or first album you bought?
Oh, this is going to show my real musical theatre colours. I bought Liza Minnelli in Cabaret. Did I ever? Oh, let me tell you what. Good times. And then I got Julie Andrews' Thoroughly Modern Millie and I just play those two on vinyl constantly.
Beatles tribute concert.
It was a questionable West End theatre choice. It was literally four men dressed as the Beatles singing a preset Beatles playlist, and it was very visually quite impressive. They weren't spot on, but it was like okay, wasn't it?
And how does this fit into the romance?
So when we worked in the theatre, we were ushers in, on the West End, and when your venue's quiet, they shift you onto a busy venue, and I was working on Dirty Dancing, so it was like pretty quiet midweek, and it was
every day it was quiet.
Crazy hens nights on the weekends.
Yeah, so I was at Spamalot, where every day was a quiet day. No one saw Spamalot at the end, which is a shame because
great show.
Spamalot's excellent.
And so we were shifted onto the Savoy Theatre, and it was this Beatles tribute band, and I'd been there once before, I think, and seen it, and it was a Beatles tribute band, but it was paying the bills, so I was down there and saw Holly there, and she didn't know how to get out of the theatre because the backstage of these places are crazy, and I was like, oh, I know how to get out of here. And
So you showed her the back door.
And now we're married.
In essence, yeah. We found out that as we were leaving the theatre, we both lived in the same area, and we ended up taking the tube together, and we're busy chatting to each other, and I was like, oh, she's really cool. She's really cool, but she's got a pixie cut hairstyle, and she's wearing all sorts of crazy clothes. She's probably a lesbian.
Sean's also a very camp man. It was same feelings in my
same,
head.
Same.
You know.
So we're like, well, that's a shame that that's never going to work out.
And because then so let's go to a club anyway.
Yeah, and then it turns later out we were both straight, so now we're married. That's how it works.
Well, what a world.
What a world.
Let's head from the back door to out there. What is out there?
It's our newest show. It is our shot at trying to weave the interactive world that we create with Bureau, which is a very language-based show, into a show that is equally as interactive but told through visual storytelling. And in space, no one can hear you scream, so what a better place to set a non-talking show, but in space. So there's blacklight, and there's puppetry, and there's probably projection of, you know, like changeable captured projection kind of things going on. It's a big, lofty, ambitious show. It's the first time we're having a team that's more than just the two of us. And our hope is that it scales us up from being fringe fare to main stage fare. We want to take the work we're doing up, and we want to take it more global, and we want to take it to places that don't speak English, in essence.
To Mars and places like
that.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, all those places.
We want to be on the Golden Disc. That's the dream.
When did you first learn about the Golden Disc?
I'd heard of it, but we saw at Edinburgh Fringe the most spectacular piece of theatre maybe that I've ever seen in my life. It was stunning. And it was all about the Golden Disc and how it came to be and how it existing and being out in the universe affects us and what the long-term actual lifespan of it is.
And sort of each segment of the show was told to one of the tracks. So in essence, it was a jukebox musical, but not.
Genius.
But it was underscored with like the tracks that were on it and beautiful visual imagery. And it was a very tender, soft piece where it was basically someone interviewing the inventor of the ship that carries it.
And he was tracking it.
And he was tracking it, yeah.
I don't know. I think it was partially from truth and partially artistic license.
Because very recently they released like a box set of related material.
Yeah.
And
right.
Of course, Carl Sagan and everyone else got involved in that as well. How does Out There relate then in terms of storytelling?
Out There is about what the kids want to project into space. So in the same sense as that record is a record of human existence out in the world and telling our story, we're encouraging the children to affect the story that we are going to share about space together. And that might be what happens when we arrive on a planet. It might be how we interact with the beings that are already on that planet.
What those beings are.
The look and feel and the decisions we make to try and save this astronaut that has become lost in space and needs to get home.
The feeling of it, the warmth, the cold, the lack of atmosphere or the motion in terms of gravity, for example.
And at the same time, a curiosity. A lot of the way we want to play with the aliens, for a lack of a better term, is we want them to be really, while our human character is discovering this alien world, we want the aliens to be discovering the human world because they've like snuck onto the ship or something. They're going to find things like a hammer and have no idea what a hammer is, and hilarity will ensue by what these creatures have discovered and how they use it.
And how the children, I guess, explain how those things are used as well.
Exactly.
I think equally it is a affirmation of human ability. I think it is an affirmation of, like, you can do anything. I think what's important, so I'm going to be playing the astronaut character in this show, and it's important. We had a big discussion about this, and we were like, it's important that it is a female and it is not mentioned.
They are a woman.
Yep.
But nothing said.
But
yeah,
unmentioned.
And they
yeah.
are just doing it, and they are exploring, and they are able to do things by themselves, and they, as a character, also need help, and they can ask for help. They, again, coming back to the trust thing, are putting their trust as a character in the audience to get them out of this sticky situation that they've
got themselves into. Because our audience is basically going to be ground control in the show, and they are going to make a series of decisions and choices and experiences that will affect what is happening on stage. What's fun is trying to work out how we do that with visual language or sound rather than specific spoken words. So there's a lot of discussion at the moment about glow stick armbands and things, and you know, if you want something to go left, for example, you hold one arm up, that shows. Or a lot of the show is going to be a cross between a video game and a theme park ride and a piece of theatre. So it's this, it's a very immersive, interactive world where I don't think any two performances will ever end the same way. It's going to be really interesting to see.
Which you like very much, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we live for that.
Not knowing and
that
making a mess.
Do you document at the end of these shows what does happen so that you can look at that eclectic range that happens across a month, a year?
We quite often record audio of shows and listen back to them. For a while, we were doing a podcast with the stories, but again, it was very time-consuming to transpose and then retell the stories and record. Now we do still record most shows, but we also go off stage and we reflect on things that happen, and we reflect on what was the craziest part of the show and what was the funniest part and what spoke to us and what those kind of things as well. And that experience is important as well. But at the same time, theatre is ephemeral and it only happens once.
Yes.
So sometimes it's equally as nice to forget. One of the funniest things, especially out of Adelaide, is a lot of the reviews have sort of like reflected what has happened in the show.
Quite specifically.
They'll like retell some of the stories that have happened, and it's like, that's fantastic, but the next person that's coming to see this show won't get that. They will not. And in a sense, it's great that that's been captured, because someone's captured that moment that only will ever happen once.
If we gave our astronaut a guitar, what songs are they playing in space?
Oh, David Bowie. David Bowie, Life on Mars.
Specific.
Yep.
Write down. No.
She's out there. She's playing Life on Mars on Jupiter.
As we round up, let's get back to the couple. Both of you are from Brightmore Productions. What song brings you guys together?
You know.
Yeah, it is. Oh gosh, what's it called though? Now I've like. It's, I know, I'm singing.
Do you want me to take
yeah,
this?
Yeah, go, please do.
The song When the Money's Gone.
Oh gosh, you went that way. Okay.
Oh yeah, no, that's where I went.
Yep, okay.
Oh.
Where are you going?
I was going to do our like first dance at the wedding.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
but
specific.
Okay. I feel like, so from the Cher show specifically, hit Broadway musical The Cher Show, When the Money's Gone, crossed with Baby It's All or Nothing. And it is...
The anthem of our last
so
year.
So it is the point in the Cher show where Sonny and Cher are making their way up in Vegas. And it is like... It feels so, whenever we listen to it, we're like, we're there. Like, this is our life now. And like, this is what.
By the end of the song, they're Sonny and Cher. Mm-hmm. But at the start of the song, they're like, we've got no money. That's been this weird anthem. And I think because we keep having these instances with weird money situations that don't come through, and we feel like the struggling artists sometimes.
And we're like, we worked together in a warehouse, and it was an amazing job, and it was a beautiful time, and we loved it. And we quit that job to go to Edinburgh Fringe and to move here.
So what was the wedding song? Wedding dance song.
It is... It's so naff. It's I Love You Always Forever. What's that official... Is that the official title of
it? That might be what it's called.
And it's just... it's because at some point Holly would say, like, I love you, and I would just fill out with, like, always forever, near or far, closer together, every... And it just sort of, like, became this thing.
Stuck.
And it just kept happening and happening and happening. It was sort of a joke to start with. And then when it came to picking a playlist for the wedding, and we made three playlists plus, like, the actual, like... ceremony bits
are
well.
These on like Spotify
yeah
are they publicly available
they're yeah. very good
are yeah. they very publicly available
oh totally
I think so.
Sean if yep. we could that'd be great
yeah yeah we'll link you up to them the hours and hours of joy
yeah
there's a jazz one there's a funky one and there's like a dance one as the night progressed I think there's an instrumental I think it's like a postmodern jukebox version of like Carly Rae Jepsen song on there as well
oh we love Carly Rae
we do love a lot of Carly Rae Jepsen which is
we are
interesting.
The tackiest people you'll ever meet
what is it with Carly Rae that you like
She's just...
Who's out on 604 Records, by the way.
I think there is something a bit underdogish about her as well. She obviously had the one-hit wonder, but then she's still going. And the thing is...
She's smashing them out. They're great.
The albums are really good. I think she is so overlooked as, like, an incredible pop musician. The Emotion albums that she was... There's Emotion and Emotion Side B. And, like, Emotion Side B has such, like, an 80s kind of... feeling to it, but at the same time, I come from this like musical theater background, and I sit and listen to those albums. There is a story here. This is one of those albums you probably could translate to the stage and have a jukebox musical on. And I love that kind of storytelling in a song like that as well, which is funny because then like on the other end of the scale, then we'll listen to like Macklemore. Macklemore is like our pump-up jam. And I think about like
and like Lizzo as well.
Yeah,
we're big into Lizzo at the moment.
But then we'll go straight back to like some jazz. And we'll have some, like, classic Louis Armstrong playing, or...
I love a little French cafe Spotify playlist. That gets me through the day.
And then chuck on, like, the suite from, like, the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland, and that's sort of, like, our musical tastes encapsulated.
Mika on the top.
Oh, and Mika, yeah, of course, Mika.
So which one of the Spotify playlists did you end up going with for the dance, though?
That was, we had like just a small playlist of all the key songs. This was the song we were going to walk out of the ceremony to from the film Up, the main scoring from that.
Married Life, I think
Married
it's called.
Married Life,
yeah,
and it, the Disneyland version. And it's so beautiful. And I think it stops before it gets to like the heart-wrenching bit. They lose each other in that opening scene of Up.
We had Moon River, didn't we?
Yeah, you entered to Moon
aisle,
River.
To Moon
yeah.
River. And then...
Performed by who, though?
Audrey Hepburn.
Audrey.
Of course.
Because Holly, less so now that she has the longer hair, but when I met her... It looked like Audrey Hepburn.
What's your favourite children's song?
What is that Sesame Street album that we listened to on the way to Echuca?
The Silly Songs one?
Is that the one?
Which song are you thinking from that album? The Oh, we're going for a ride.
Yeah.
We're going to sit behind the wheel.
Yeah.
I'm going to drive a tractor or something like that. I don't know. It's a Sesame Street, something like that. we love a Disney park. We love Disney things. And maybe it's not 100% children themed, but the song There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow, which was part of the World's Fair attractions that Walt Disney created. I love that song, that notion of like there's a really exciting day ahead, no matter what the day was like today, there's a great big beautiful tomorrow. That's a really inspiring number.
Do you both believe that there's a child in every one of us?
100%.
Always?
Always.
Till the day
forever.
We die?
Always.
Forever. You can be the grumpiest, oldest, like my granddad on my dad's side, he was hilarious. He was Northern, British Northern. He got a...
mobility scooter.
And my dad's cousin got him like a old git thing to put on the back, and he thought that was so funny. And I think like if there's joy there, there's joy everywhere, isn't there? Like everyone's a kid, everyone wants to play, and everyone wants to enjoy fun.
So what's the most childish thing you've done, Sean?
I do childish things all the time. I just think like you've got one shot at this. I'm not gonna
stop doing the fun stuff.
Stop doing the fun things because life says, well, you shouldn't do that, Sean. I think one of the craziest things we ever did was when we were in the UK, we did a gig and it paid us a really decent amount of money. And it was the first time in the UK we had a decent bit of money behind our belts, and it should have gone towards the wedding. But instead, we booked a trip back to Australia and we decided it was going to be a surprise. So we didn't tell my family.
We were expecting to stay in their house.
Yes. It had been 2 years. We hadn't been back to Australia in that 2 years. We hadn't ever been able to afford it. We were going to be having this wedding, so no one was sort of expecting it. We told my best friend, that was the only person that knew, Jared. And we snuck out, basically, and came to Australia. And it was midnight when we got home. And Jared picked us up from the airport, dropped us at the house. I knock on the door because I'm like, oh, the doorbell's probably a bit risky. Now, in the years that I moved out of home, suburbia encroached on my semi-rural home, but my home is still semi-rural. It's very dark. At midnight, it's not very lit, but on the other side of the road, it's lit.
Lots
suburbia.
Of houses.
So if you're a random person knocking on someone's door, why would you knock on the dark house? So I knock on the door, and my dad, who is a very gentle, placid man, is the one tasked with opening the door. And we just hear on the other side of the door, "Who is it?" Which is not my dad. And I decide not to say, "It's Sean." I go like, "Oh yeah, I'm really lost and I don't know where I'm going. Maybe you could..." And then you just hear, they're very confused on the other side of the door. And then my mum just goes, "Sean, Sean!" And then the door opens and there's hugs and there's tears. And it was only for a week. And it was just this...
completely irresponsible.
Completely irresponsible, spur of the moment thing. But I thought we
hang on. Was your mother having an affair?
No.
Who was the bloke at the door?
Oh, it was my dad.
Being gruff.
He was just being gruff. Oh. Yeah, he put on a character. So that's apparently where I get the
character
from.
I thought you caught your mum.
No. Gosh. Oh boy, that would have been completely. It was this wonderful experience where we got to be home around these people that we hadn't seen in a long time, and just have a week with them, and completely unexpected, and that was so much fun. I would never do it again because I had so much stress on the plane that they'd worked it out and the whole trip had been ruined.
But if you think about it, Sean, as a kid, that would have just been every day.
Yeah.
You would have just done that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, Holly, what's the most childish thing you've ever done?
I am endlessly childish. I think I live by the same thing that we were talking about before, where children are obsessed with things. I love to know and I love to learn and I love... So I'll find a thing and then I'll grab onto it and I'll be like, I love this thing. And when I was like 19, 18, 19, it was like dinosaurs. I was like, I'm into dinosaurs now. I want to know about dinosaurs. Didn't know about dinosaurs before. Now is the time. So I'd like go to the museums and I'd read the books and I'd like... We have so many children's books you would not believe. Like 90% of the books that I read are children's books. When I'm finished with that, I'll like get into Mika real hardcore and I'll be like, I want to know everything about this person. I want to know every song they've ever written. I want to know like where they
come
from.
I have no idea who Mika is, but that's okay.
Oh, you know Mika, Grace Kelly.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Big Girl
Beautiful. In the country at the moment. Yeah, okay, yeah. So I'm on Sunrise or something.
Wouldn't believe how angry Holly is that we drove out of Melbourne on the day that he was performing in Melbourne.
He is, and I can only encourage you to go listen to some Mika. If that's all anyone gets from this... Mika has been releasing excellent music for the last 10 years, and every single album is better than the last.
And an artist that brings you two together.
Yeah, when we were in Brisbane and about to move back, Holly decided to book tickets to see him in London, even though we had not booked flights yet. And
classic Holly move.
And then when we got there and we saw that show that night, that was the night that I was like, I'm going to marry Holly. So yeah, Mika is that.
And at the same time, I was like, I'm going to marry Mika.
Yeah, which was awkward.
And I didn't, so...
Brymore Productions, both Sean and Holly, thank you very much for joining Radio Notes.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful time.
Sean and Holly of Brymore Production. Recorded at the Holden Street Theatres in Hindmarsh, South Australia. When they cannot be found touring, they are also creating and sharing works online. To find out more about them, they can be found at brymoreproductions.com.
Thanks very much for joining us for Radio Notes for this episode, and a special thanks to both our guest, Holly and Sean Brymore, and the Holden Street Theatres for being very hospitable during our time there. Next time, we head to Queensland for an award-winning singer-songwriter, Jeremy Neal.
RadioNotesPodcast.com for show notes and links. Web design there by Steve Davis. Theme music by Martin Kennedy and All India Radio. I'm Tammy Weller. John Murch is the producer and host based in Adelaide, South Australia.